But as Autumn's lawyer has explained to me, the government doesn't really have a burden of proof in these things. NSPM 7 is not a legal framework. It's not something that has been, you know, precedent has been set by any courts on this. It is just something that the president has said and that prosecutors can then rely on to try and push a narrative to a jury, to the public. And there's no real burden of proof. They can just say that you're Antifa. And that becomes sort of gospel, according to the government, if they say it.
Jack Crosby is a senior writer at Rolling Stone magazine. We will link to your piece, Incarcerated for Life and Trump's War on the Left. We're going to continue this discussion and post it online at democracynow.org, and we'll learn more about material support for terrorism and how that relates to this case. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nicole Salazar, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena. I'm Anjali Kamath. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarlane. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane. This is a special edition of our series. We call this Conversations with Al McFarlane, powered by U.S. Bank. And let me start by thanking U.S. Bank for sponsoring this and the series, where we connect with institutions, businesses, organizations that build community. Well, today continues that series of engaging business, economic development for our community. And we're pleased to talk with Alma Flores. She's the executive director of Latino Economic Development Center. Alma, good afternoon. Bienvenido. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane.
Gracias, Al. Lovely to be here with you.
Well, let's jump right into it. You know, let's do LEDC, Latino Economic Development Center 101. Talk to us about the organization, when it was founded, and what the mission is.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on your podcast. It's lovely to be here and to share all about what we do here at LEDC for short. So LEDC started in 2003 on Lake Street in Minneapolis as more of a place-based community development corporation, some people call CDCs. That was our genesis. That was our start here in Minnesota. And it wasn't until 10 years later that there was a recognition and a need throughout the state of Minnesota to provide lending, access to capital support to the Latino and BIPOC-owned entrepreneurs in Minnesota. And at that time, in 2013, we applied to be a U.S. Treasury-backed community development financial institution, CDFI for short. And that would enable us to provide the same level of care as we were doing on Lake Street around technical assistance, business development support, but an added element of lending and access to capital, which we all know is the most critical part of any entrepreneur's life cycle. And so in 2013, becoming a CDFI, backed by the U.S. Treasury, and this is a program that is over 50 years old, that is bipartisan supported, that provides organizations, nonprofit organizations like LEDC, to provide access to capital, lending support, and it can do other things as well. It could do real estate acquisition, it could become a credit union, it could do affordable housing, but we chose to focus mainly on access to capital. And this is mainly as a response to redlining that banks did back in the day, where it restricted minorities, Black, Indigenous, people of color to have access to housing, to commercial loans for entrepreneurship development. And so the CDFI, backed by the U.S. Treasury, was put in place 50 years ago in order to counteract that and to put in place access to capital for what we would consider under-resourced, marginalized communities, mm-hmm. where the banks would typically, you know, they use the five C's to determine whether someone gets a loan. We don't just look at that. You know, those are important elements, but we're looking for different elements, character being one of them, mm-hmm. In terms of one of the five C's, and then credit to a certain extent, because we know that in order to build wealth through entrepreneurship or through commercial real estate, for instance, you need to evaluate the person mm-hmm. in a slightly different light because of just the history of not having access to these resources. And so we became a CDFI in 2013 and have been active in that space, serving statewide and part of Western Wisconsin as well. Mm-hmm. And what our mission is essentially to provide economic opportunities to Latino entrepreneurs. But we as a CDFI don't turn anyone away. Anyone mm-hmm. of any background can come to our office. We just are primarily focused from a cultural and linguistic capacity as a Latino serving CDFI, but again, we serve all. There are 40 CDFIs that serve the entire state as mm-hmm. well, and many of them are culturally specific or linguistic specific, like ours. Mm-hmm. And LEDC has focused on three primary pillars in their work, and they are business development and technical assistance. So really, it could be that startup business. It could be an existing business just needing additional care around subject matters like accounting or marketing or just reevaluating their cash flow, their finances in order for a new expansion, a new innovation, or a new technology within their place of business. The second leg is our lending, which is why we're a CDFI. And so we have a $5 million loan pool. And by definition, we're a revolving loan fund. And so the intent is we offer fair interest rates, terms that are, favorable for the client so that they can start their business, grow their business, buy equipment, working capital if they need some upfront cash to be able to pay vendors, their employees, so that when they're starting in a strong way. Mm-hmm. And the third pillar is we have a regenerative agriculture program. And a lot of people don't recognize that about us, but we do a lot of work and have been for the past 13 years as well, serving farmers and workers in terms of gaining access to farm and owning farms of their own and working, tilling the farms on their own and buying the equipment that they need to run their farm. And so we do a lot of work in that space as well.
Let me do two things. One is have you spend more time on explaining what community development financial institution means, how that works. You said you've got a $5 million loan fund. Where does the money come from? And how does the money you're able to assemble differ from money that I might want to go to my bank to get or to some other kind of investor or resource? So what's that unique need and niche being served by the community development financial institution system?
No, great question, Al. And it's complicated because no one CDFI has the exact same formula mm-hmm. in terms of how it is fundraising for their loan fund. So it's a combination of a variety of things, and I'm going to explain them now. Primarily, much of our funding for our loan pool and for the work of the CDFI comes from philanthropy. So we have wonderful partners. Minnesota is blessed I got to tell you, I came from Oregon, and Minnesota has a significantly higher portion of philanthropic giving. And so we rely on that.
Why do you think that is? Just this is not on script, but why do you think this community is different from Oregon?
Yeah, no, Oregon. Well, for one, Oregon only has one Fortune 500 company, and Minnesota has 17. Mm-hmm. So just by that alone, and of course, there's philanthropic giving within those large scale Fortune 500 companies as well, like Target, right? Target, mm-hmm. 3M, Cargill, like these are major players in the philanthropic space. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of the bigger differences. Minnesota's also has been very savvy in its policy around economic development and understands the value of CDFIs in that space. Oregon, by contrast, economic development is not one of its strengths. Housing, affordable housing development, and social services, and of course, just other, other ecosystems that it has is just very different from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's part of the reason why philanthropic giving is much more robust here than my experience in Oregon. But that's just one element of how the fund gets pulled together. We work with banks as well. I mean, US Bank is one of our partners in terms of program-related investment, PRI for short. Another term that you'll hear is EQ2. Don't ask me what the EQ stands for because I'm still trying to figure that out, but it's EQ2 for short. And it's similar to a PRI that banks can offer to organizations like LEDC to have a loan fund. And as a matter of fact, we have one of those EQ2s with US Bank to provide loan capital for our in our loan fund. So we have other partners in the space, both national intermediaries as well as local. And so that's really the bulk of the the loan fund.
And so what can you buy with $5 million? What does $5 million do in this space? How many entrepreneurs businesses can you support and serve?
No, another great question, Al. So so we have some policies. We can't lend more than $250,000 to any one individual or any one company or business, mm-hmm. LLC. And then if real estate's involved, we can go up to $350,000 mm-hmm. with board approval. So what that has gotten us over the 13 years, we have about 200 clients in our, who have received funding at some level or another, and it could be as little as $5,000 all mm-hmm. the way to $350,000 and everything in between. Our sweet spot has been around $112,000. That's our average. Okay. And so what that gets you is a new startup along a commercial corridor to help revitalize a community, a neighborhood, a corner within your neighborhood, and activates it with an entrepreneur. I don't know if you knew this, Al, but 36% of all startups are either immigrant or Latino.
Well, sure.
Specifically. Yeah. So we're talking about more than one third of the business starts within a state or a community are happening by Latino and immigrant entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And so what that gets you is diversity along your corridor, diversity of offerings, whether that's food, retail, trade, construction, accounting, whatever the sector might be and what the gap might be within your community and neighborhood, it's happening with our help and those of the banking community and other potentially CDFIs and other sort of, I'm sure the ecosystem is quite large for helping entrepreneurs, I have to say. Like, I've been very impressed with it as well. Like, we are just one player of many in supporting the entrepreneurship ecosystem here. And so what does that get you? We have about close to 200 businesses that we've served. We've probably assisted about 1,500 new employees within the startup of these businesses, which is also important. It isn't just the entrepreneur that benefits, but it's creating jobs as well. Within that community. So that's important. And it's contributing to the economy I always say to my team, like, there are only two ways someone can make money. You're either an employee like me, or you're self-employed and you are employing others. Mm-hmm. There is a third, and that is you are independently wealthy. And I think the two of us would not be on this call right now. Nope. if we were in that category.
That's right. Yeah, I'm working. I work.
Me too.
Yeah. But yeah, and it's wonderful, Alma, that we're in a community, in a state, in a country that allows us to dream, to think, to try. Mm-hmm. We may fail. We may fail two or three times, but there is an attitude and an expectation that, you know, keep trying. Nothing beats a failure like a try. So people are encouraged and systems are in place to support people who venture into creating enterprises and employment and grow economies mm-hmm. within the cultural context, right? Mm-hmm. So you started off also talking about the five C's, and you mentioned credit and character. Just as a refresher, what are the five C's?
Oh boy, Al.
Put you on the spot, huh?
I'm going to have to Google that one. And I don't know if I can right on the screen.
Okay. All right.
Your catch. Yeah. Oh, credit is another one. Well, credit, character, or the two that I already mentioned. Oh my
capital,
gosh.
Capital, probably. Capital.
Capital, of course. But yes, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
I would guess customers would be one. Maybe, I don't know. I'm freestyling here.
We're both guessing here. I mean, you definitely caught me on that one. So sorry. Well,
that's rich. That's okay. It's okay. It's good because, you know, this is a conversation. These two of us who both are committed to building the economies of our community and of our country. And this is how we do it. We talk. We talk and we learn from each other. We share and hopefully, by using this platform, the conversation with Al McFarland, our radio broadcast on KFAI and our streaming across a variety of social media platforms. This program is aired on YouTube channels of Insight News and of the Black Press of America National Newspaper Publishers Association, which, by the way, has an ongoing partnership with the Association of Hispanic and Latino Publishers Nationwide. So we've got these connections here that are expansive, national, but they all have to do with elevating and celebrating the cultural genius our communities bring to society at large. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds perfect to me. And Al, I cheated. I looked it up just to make sure that I can save myself.
Technology is amazing.
Character, capacity, capital, collateral, that's the one, and conditions. So like the economic climate and industry trends, and that those all feed into how an entrepreneur decides, how the lending arm decides that they are worthy of capital.
So next question, then, you know, we kind of, you know, the five C's and the general vision, resourcing through instruments like CDFI, Community Development Financial Institutions. So with those things aggregated, assembled inside your organization, what are some of the specific programs that you host for small business owners?
And if you're talking more like on the business development technical assistance arm or the lending piece or both?
Let's do both. Let's start one and then the other, you know.
So
my goal, Alma, is to ensure that you can use every moment to promote and explain and invite our community to really lean into the assets that you are bringing to community.
Yeah. So what's special about LADC is a lot of things, but I think the focus area is the trust building within the community, and that mm-hmm. happens sometimes organically and sometimes inorganically. And a lot of, especially post-COVID, I think we entered a new realm of how we, you know, deliver our service. You know, having come out from COVID and still, you know, people feeling like they need to not leave their homes and stay put and have an online workshop or tailored mm-hmm. workshop that could be accessed online has been the new sort of way of doing business. that doesn't always work for the Latino community because we are very driven by relationships. Mm-hmm. And so our staff continues to do that type of work. They like to meet people where they are. They like to hold workshops, trainings in person. And that's really our strength and our forte is being able to tailor our engagements, if you will, with our, future clients or existing clients to really understand what their needs are. And one of the things that we do the typical things around workshops, how to start your business, how to market your business, how to find the right accountant. I mean, it sounds so banal, but it's so important to make sure that you have the right accountant and they're doing the right things for you. Having legal support, making sure that you have filed the proper paperwork for your LLC, having the right person representing you to file for, the license at the state. Even just understanding what all of the HR rules, there's so many as it relates to, payroll and personnel management and when you start your business. So all of that is covered either through direct one-on-one conversations or through workshops or webinars, and because we've adapted to the COVID, post-COVID expectations and needs. And then they're done in Spanish and in English. Mm-hmm. And so we're given that, Latino serving primarily, we do offer mm-hmm. Our programming in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the lending arm, we have five primary products to offer loan programs, and it can be anywhere from buying a car for your business, because we know how can you get anything done if you don't have a working automobile to get around, either for inventory drives or even to visit customers you might be serving. And then, of course, we have an equipment and furnishings loan product, because you also need to be able to have a functioning business with the items that you need to operate. And then there are other parts of like real estate acquisition, as I've mentioned, working capital as a loan product. And then they have different funders. And so some of our funders offer different, want to see different rates and loan mm-hmm. terms. Mm-hmm. And so if you meet the criteria that was put together by our loan staff, then you might benefit from a lower interest loan. Our baseline loan interest is about 7%, but we do have some funders who offer them at 5%. Mm-hmm. And that's part of their sort of covenants related to mm-hmm. how we deploy their money. And so we work with the customer, we do the intake, we really try to dig deep in terms of what their needs are, and then offer the technical support and so forth. And the same, everything I just described is also true of our farmers. So it mm-hmm. isn't just bricks and mortar entrepreneurs, it's also our farmers and our farming community.
7% is pretty good price for money right now, I think. What's the general expectation in the marketplace for the cost of borrowing? Is it
so it depends. It can be higher. I mean, the interest rate is evaluated based on the risk. Mm-hmm. So if this is a new entrepreneur who may have only 1 year of experience, for instance, and this is a hypothetical, mm-hmm. Has 1 year of experience and has a business plan where they really want to start their own restaurant and what have you. And we know restaurants are high intensity capital uses. And their survival rates are very, very low. and so, that interest rate might be 12%. And that's mm-hmm. pretty much in line. Some banks and some CDFIs may not even lend them any money or right. might lend at 19% just to be safe. But then, it's a balancing act. There's no cookie cutter approach or term sheet for everyone.
I've heard the term patient capital.
Capital.
Would you sort of describe the opportunity, the funds as more patient for your vendors or not? Is that the right term?
So the patient capital, the way I use it for us is that the funding sources that we get from philanthropy and from our bank partners, mm-hmm. Leveraging Community Reinvestment Act, I consider that patient capital. Okay. Because many times they're lending us money, this PRI, EQ2 money, at very low interest rates with the intent of helping and supporting entrepreneurs as a CDFI. That I consider patient capital because they're being patient with us to lend versus deploying all in 1 year. So usually our terms are 5 to 10 years for that. You can say, like you're pointing out, that that could be the same terminology for our entrepreneurs, but our terms in terms of the amortization, you know, timeline is between 5 and 10 years as well. So we're kind of in the same boat, except our money, we're kind of a conduit for deploying these monies that the philanthropy and banks have entrusted in us.
I'm Al McFarland. This is a special edition of Conversations with Al McFarland. We call this The Conversation with Al McFarland, powered by U.S. Bank. And this is one of a series where we talk with organizations and individuals who are building community and looking at the economics of community development. And that certainly applies to my guest today. My guest is Alma Flores. She's executive director of LEDC, Latino Economic Development Center, in St. Paul. Alma, once again, thank you so much. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsors and supporters at U.S. Bank for, you know, they're walking the walk, you know, showing up. And I think that's really part of what they mean to you as well. Before I ask you about that relationship, what are the challenges that typical small businesses face? Are they the same as they've always been? Are there nuances now that are afforded by either, you know, trends that are global, the cost of fuel, you know, being able to get product that you want to bring to market, things like tariffs, for example, right? Tariffs make a difference. And technology, certain things that people used to do are being done by machines now. How does that changing landscape reconfigure the set of needs that you think and discover small businesses are facing right now?
Yeah, I mean, if I look at our typical client and conversations I've had with many of them, obviously being an access to capital provider, that is, we're filling a need, but we can't do it alone. The need is greater than what we can provide. So access to capital is still continues to be the number one barrier and constraint to many small business startups or existing businesses. I would start there. In terms of all the other sort of trends we're seeing, certainly check, check, check. I mean, those are certainly the same barriers, although many of them are newer. Workforce development or workforce, I think, is probably my number two concern right now. We are seeing with all of the stance around immigration. Immigration concerns have always been an issue through every administration. How they're handled is what's different. But I think our economy, if we're going to maintain the economy that we have and have come to love, you have to have a level of immigration to support the workforce needs for many of these entrepreneurs. You can't have one without the other. So, and it's being exacerbated right now because of the fear people have, the real fear that's out there in terms of immigration issues and the like. And so I would say the second element is that I would say the high cost of real estate or the high cost of even leasing space because of either limited space available, marginal space that isn't being upgraded, but still charged, you know, still being leased or sold at a very high rate where entrepreneurs don't feel secure in their investment as entrepreneurs. Certainly tariffs, certainly gas prices, those of course absolutely impact the cost of doing business. In line with that, I would say also permitting and how cities work with entrepreneurs in their community in terms of the permit fees, the license fees, all of that. I mean, they just keep adding up, right? Mm-hmm. And then what's left at the end of the day, people are going to wonder, like, is this even a good idea to start a business? So that's the part that I worry about, that mm-hmm. spirit of entrepreneurship is going to get lost when people start to add everything that's mm-hmm. Coming in line with what they need to do to operate their business. And so as much as we can do at LEDC and what our sort of economic development partners in the ecosystem can do to minimize that aggregate, those aggregate barriers and issues, mm-hmm. the better it will be for future entrepreneurs. Technology, of course. I mean, AI has taken up so much space in a good way and in a to be seen way, and in many cases negative way, to your point of like mechanization of factory lines and so forth, and even AI hitting like at that lower level. But I think there's still hope for our entrepreneur community. I mean, we just offered our first AI webinar for our clients and future clients, because it was needed. Yeah. And I did not want the Latino community to be left out, mm-hmm. Because that happens so many times, right? New mm-hmm. technology, new trends come forward. And by the time it hits BIPOC communities, the trend is over.
Right. Yeah, too late.
And benefited from it. So yeah. So that's certainly something that we are cognizant of and want to be responsive to.
So Alma, you know, I raised the question about challenges that small businesses face right now. And I want you to sort of go inside to the other part of that question. And you touched on it a little bit, but I'll have you sort of come back. I think the challenges or the stumbling blocks or the markers, you know, for getting into business, you know, those things are fairly well documented, and we have experience and stories that tell us. But beneath that, and both in front of it and behind it, there is a vision of opportunity that drives individuals and that drives the community as well. So I would love for you to talk about, number one, the presence, the growth, the vitality of the Latino community and other BIPOC communities, but focus on Latino community in Minnesota, Wisconsin, where your footprint is. And what are the numbers in that community? What is that economy within itself, and how does that economy really strengthen and grow the overall business environment for all Minnesotans, for all the people in the region, for our country? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Elle, like, there are only two ways of making money, right? And when you are an individual who has barrier after barrier in your way, and then you compound that with either your immigration status, mm-hmm. your language, mm-hmm. Cultural norms. It's just compounded, right? So then the Latino community, you know, has two choices. They're going to either be somebody's employee, or they're going to start their own business and follow their passion. One thing that I really appreciate about having a passport, which only half of our community, you know, our society has a passport, and they don't mm-hmm. get to venture out and see what life is outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. Is you get to visit places where you see that in action. When I visited Mexico City the other last year, and that was my first time going. It's been about 15 years since I last visited. Mm-hmm. It was so wonderful to see, like, what we consider marginal populations obviously is dominant there. And the level of entrepreneurship and spirit around entrepreneurship was mm-hmm. profound. Those same people whether it's Mexico, Colombia, Peru, wherever they might be coming from, a Spanish-speaking Latin American country, coming to the U.S. and wanting to, you know, what we used to call, I don't know that it exists anymore, the American dream.
Sure.
I was having this discussion with my husband the other day. Does the American dream still exist today? And really wanting
to... You have to call it a sueño nuevo. Algo nuevo, something new, a new dream.
Oh, milagroso sueño.
Okay, yeah.
A miracle dream. No, I mean, and they come here and they start. And my God, the resiliency, what I have seen and witnessed is the resiliency. I mean, we had COVID, we had Operation Metro Surge, we had George Floyd uprising, yeah, that really impact, especially here in Minnesota, that really impacted entrepreneurs and their way of life and their families and the employees they serve, the vendors they support, all of that being put on display and on fire. Mm-hmm. And they, most of them, although I have to say that they are struggling right now, they have come out stronger. Mm-hmm. Or they have stayed the course because they have to. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, they have no other options. They have to make it work for them, yeah, and their families. And I would say that the Latinos know how to do that. I'm not saying that they're not suffering or they, it's easy for them and there aren't other concerns that we should be all talking about around mental health and just ensuring that they are taking care of themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That still exists, but
I think it means a lot. It means a lot to, yeah, you. I can see that. Yeah, thank you for just being so forthcoming about that. You know, and even taking from there, Alma, talk about the vitality, the size of the community. Because when I started Insight 50 years ago, the African American community was very small. But it's grown by leaps and bounds. That same kind, yeah, of growth has happened in the Latino community, yeah, in the Asian community. So we're really dealing with a new configuration of community, yeah, and of society and of culture. And what I discovered is that each of us brings these marvelous gifts, great understanding, great values, right? And these values are really universal, they're global, and they're ancient values, values that have come down generations and generations and generations. That's the attitude about work, about the responsibility, you know, of being a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, you know, a grandparent, and being active and present in community, and also the vision, the expectation, and the hope that we can always improve, that improvement, yeah, is possible, and that I've got a part to play in that happening. So talk about the robustness of the Latino community in Minnesota from 20 years ago. You might not have been here then, but what, no, you know about it, to where it is now, because it's a different story. It's a different day.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate that we haven't updated a lot of our Minnesota-based demographics around the Latino community. The last report that really had a solid understanding of the demographic presence was done in 2019. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure from 2019 to today, there's been more growth than I'm aware of that, mm-hmm, we haven't really tracked good information around. But we're talking about, from my knowledge on the entrepreneurship side, business development is 16,000 entrepreneurs exist, mm-hmm, throughout the state. I believe the population is, we're at 7% of the entire state population is Latino or mm-hmm, Latino, foreign born, mm-hmm, Latino, Hispanic classifications. And so, you know, I don't know what the numbers are for the African-American community and what that growth look like, mm-hmm, but I know that it's on the rise, and it's, mm-hmm, the trend is that Latino populations have been growing in many states throughout the nation, and Minnesota is no exception. I think the economy is a good one here, which is an attractor. It's a pull factor from an immigration standpoint to the area. There's a strong workforce need throughout the state that are separate from, you know, entrepreneurship starts, where their employees, people are moving here, climate refugees. Like, there's just a lot of pull factors to Minnesota from Spanish-speaking countries or from other states that have a large, you know, California is not affordable to live in, but there's a predominant presence of Latinos there. Same with Texas and Arizona and some of these southwestern states that are, the climate just isn't palatable anymore, and Minnesota is becoming more of a recipient of some of those, that workforce, and possibly even entrepreneurs. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that play into, you know, the population and the population growth and the types. And I welcome that. I think it's absolutely critical for us to have flow, because I'm also hearing the opposite, that there's an outflow. People are leaving Minnesota. So if there's a decrease in our population, it needs to be balanced out with, you know, inbound migration as well. So those are all important, and Latinos are no different from anyone else when they're making decisions about where to live. Right. When I first moved here 4 years ago and I met other Latinas, and I'm like, what brought you here? It's so damn cold.
Yep.
And I'm like, wow, there are Latinos in even the coldest place in the U.S., which was wonderful. Like, it speaks to that resiliency again, right? Like, even in the cold, they'll trek to their business.
But, you know, our people who live in, say, California or Texas or Florida will say, why are y'all up there? What? And they don't believe that we're here, but we are here.
My skin color has changed a little bit. It's become very pale. As a result. but no, I just to go back to your question, I think, yes, they bring vibrancy. The numbers are growing from what I can tell, even though the data isn't there for me to support, you know, support it from that standpoint. But certainly people are seeing Minnesota as a great place to raise a family. I think that is super important, that the schools are excellent and they're looking, like, again, that American dream, wanting their kids to have a good education that exists, wanting to be able to, you know, raise their families here, you know, raise, you know, start their businesses and help them continue to grow. I will say, and we haven't really touched on this, that one of the barriers, even though I've said, like, barriers around language and cultural and all of that, is there still an undercurrent, I would say, of racism that exists in this fine state, that I'm hopeful that we, you know, we'll all learn that we're all human at the end at the end of the day, that our differences, whatever they might be, and I know this is, you know, going to be true for the African-American community, the Asian community, and even, you know, with Islamophobia being rampant, that you know, our, communities of color really need to stand up and support one another during these trying times, that we are human at the end of the day.
One of the things that's important, and I think immigration is at the center of this, is the ability of communities here to support communities back at home. My family is Jamaican Cuban, right? And, you know, remittances back to parents or cousins or even to businesses or in preparation for returning home to retire. Lots of people who came to this country or came to UK on British passports worked, you know, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. They were teachers or contractors or builders or, you know, nurses, health professionals. And then when they reached 65, 70, they figured they'd like some more sun, more of the year. And many of them go back home, and they've invested over a long period of time in building homes and building communities and supporting other young people in their community to both go to school and to be entrepreneurs. And so there's this dynamic, which is, I believe, what I would say from our point of view is one of the good sides of globalization. We are able to do business with each other in ways that only major corporations could in the past, and in ways that only states could do before that. The technology really affords us direct opportunities to exchange goods, services, gifts, expectations, knowledge, and with an intention of it being beneficial on both sides, not an extractive or exploitative way, but a regenerative process that we are examining the benefit of our experience here over a generation and able to provide the lessons of that to our neighborhoods back at home, if that's Mexico City, or if it's Havana, La Habana, or if it's Kingston, or, you know, Hong Kong, could be anywhere. And I think that's a good part. And I think that the that adds to the value, how we also can import and buy the artifacts and the flavors and the styles and the trips to keep us connected to our people in the old country. What do you think about that?
Oh my God, you have, I'm agreeing with 100% of what you just said. And I was thinking to myself, wow, all rocks. No, I agree completely with everything you said. I that is the beauty of our world, is the fact that we could cross-pollinate and infuse our cultural norms within our greater society. Like, oh my God, that, I mean, that's, this is why on one hand, 50% of people who have passports and are traveling about and doing that engagement and bringing back flavors, as you put it, back to the US to reinforce the real need behind why diversity, why different experiences have something to bring to the table when we're all, we don't have homogenous thinking. How boring is that? Right. So no, I love it.
Yeah, and people don't often understand that even within the Latino community, as the Black community, there are, you know, different
differences, yes.
Cultural strands, national strands.
Yeah.
You know, your experience as a Ghanaian will be different from a Jamaican, different from Antiguan or from South African. You're all African people, African Americans now, but you still bring different histories, different legacies.
Yeah. I mean, Latino community is the same. We're not a monolith. We don't have one set of vocabulary that we all understand. Just because it's Spanish does not mean it's the same.
I'm going to close the program in asking you to talk about your personal story. But before I get to that, I wanted to ask you to take a few minutes to talk about your facility. You've got a new building. And I don't know if you have any, I should have asked before if you had any images of it or if it's on your website at all, if you have pictures of what you're doing. If you do, we can have our producer sort of pull them up. But talk about the new facility that Latino Economic Development Center is building. What's the picture?
Absolutely. So Plaza del Sol, which in English translate to Soul Plaza, like or Sun Plaza, Sun Plaza. And this is in St. Paul, the east side of St. Paul, which just a little background on east side of St. Paul. We located here about 10 years ago from Lake Street in Minneapolis, primarily to do what we did do on Lake Street, which was to help revitalize and be part of the solution for an area that needs a lot of support. St. Paul, east side St. Paul, if you didn't realize this, has some of the highest disparities of the entire state. Highest poverty rates, lowest education attainment, high out-of-state property owners, all of the factors that don't lend themselves to prosperous opportunities for the community. or prosperity to thrive here. So we located here with that purpose, and we're building this facility, Plaza del Sol, to serve a couple of purposes. One is to be a placemaking partner in Eastside. So we have a building, it's 26,000 square feet, it's two stories. It's at 990 Payne, and for your producer, the address to that specific website is www.plazadelsolmn.org, and you will find all of the elements that you're looking for to learn more about it and to understand the purpose. And I'll tell you now, it's to help incubate and to help be part of the solution on the ground, bringing opportunities, incubating small businesses through our market hall. So we'll have five market hall vending opportunities for entrepreneurs to start. And there'll be a communal dining area alongside that. And then there'll be a 24-hour, 7 days a week commissary kitchen. And a commissary kitchen is something that caterers use, food cart owners use, but anyone who wants to be a boutique entrepreneur and wants to bake bread, make ice cream, you know, try out their grandmother's recipe and see if it's something that they want to bring to the market through either the farmer's market or through even Whole Foods or, maybe Trader Joe's or Target will want to carry it. We want to be part of that. So the commissary kitchen will help create those entrepreneurs. And then on the second floor will be an event center. And originally the plan was for it to be a Latino focused event center so that the quinceañeras and bodas, which are, rites of passage for the Latino community to celebrate when they turn 15, quinceañera, and then bodas is just Spanish for weddings. But to have a space that they could use and be part of the community and be in community. But it's open to anyone for any event throughout the year. And then LEDC is actually going to be moving its offices from its current location in Eastside St. Paul on Margaret Street to 990 Payne when we are up and operating. It is still under construction, and we are just in the final throes of getting certificate of occupancy where we can open to the public and have a soft opening, hopefully by September 1st.
Fantastic. That's really right around the corner. That's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah. And, and you're right next to the bank, right?
Yes, U.S. Bank is right next door. And I think I mentioned LEDC has been banking with U.S. Bank for over 15 years. So they have been a strong partner. And we're looking forward to not having to drive all the way to that branch to deposit our funds, but we can just walk straight across.
Next door. Yeah. Get a pneumatic tube to run from your building to theirs.
Hey, let's bring it back. I love those things.
Well, I want to take a minute to have you, if you want to, talk about your special relationship with U.S. Bank. And I never hesitate in telling people that my company, McFarland Media Insight News, our very first advertiser in this publication in 1970, I think we started the magazine in 1974.
Wow.
You might not have been born then.
I don't know if
you were.
I was.
Okay.
But just 2 years old.
Okay. Well, that's when I started Insight in 74 and bought it in 76. But my first advertiser was actually U.S. Bank. And wow. So they've been with me, through thick and thin. And it's not that I'm saying, I am expressing my gratitude, but I'm also talking about their presence in the community in general. So I want to give them credit for being present. I want to shout out our friend Greg Cunningham and his team, all the people over at US Bank, because they are also not only doing the work, but making sure that platforms like this can talk about the work to encourage and support others who want to do it, who want to enter it, to support the community ideation of what progress and economic development are. So I give them a lot of credit. I don't know, how do they show up to you?
In a variety of ways. So I've only been with LEDC for just under 2 years, but we, LEDC's board of directors has had a lot of volunteer time from U.S. Bank. Currently, we have two board members, Carlos Lamboglia and Eduardo Mosqueda, who have, I don't know what their time frame is at U.S. Bank. I won't guess. But they have been so gracious with their time serving on our board and being great governance partners with me in terms of their oversight of the organization and the strategy and the vision for the work. We also have several volunteers from other parts of U.S. Bank serving on our lending committee. Nancy Hazelton has been on our lending committee well before I was even at LEDC and has been wonderful to work with. I've recently asked if she can serve also on our philanthropy committee just to have some of that additional insight. We do have another U.S. Bank community member on our advancement committee outside of Nancy on the lending. So
it's important, you know, and I, again, always take any opportunity to shout out, to applaud U.S. Bank. And my purpose is not only to applaud them, but to encourage other businesses to do the same, to step up, because we're all in this together and we're going to make change together. I want to pivot the last few minutes, if you don't mind, Alma, and I didn't really warn you on this, but so just flow with me on this, right? I love getting personal stories. Okay. And you've told me that you had gone to Mexico, you know, recently last year, it hadn't been in 15 years. What's Alma's story? how did you come to this work that you're in?
Yeah.
And whose shoulders do you stand on? I think in our communities, our cultures, we really do think about the ones that preceded us, our grandparents and their parents, and as far back as we can remember. And I believe that we all feel like we're, if not guided, at least somehow informed by the aspiration of mi gente, my people, our people, right? So what is the Alma Flores story?
So the Alma Flores story is I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, to immigrant parents, both migrated from Mexico in their early 20s. I'm a PK. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's a pastor's kid. Yep. Okay. I am a pastor's kid. And so my father.
And I am too, but go ahead.
Okay. He started preaching in the Los Angeles area after going to seminary in California. And my mother was sort of the type of woman who was atypical of, married a pastor with the intent of being the Sunday school teacher and the piano player. So that's what her role was. And she later, got her licensing for nursing just because being a pastor's wife doesn't always, and having a pastor for a father and a husband doesn't always pay the bills. And so she needed to have outside work. And so I grew up in that environment of like church 4 days out of the week and then school. And so there, it was ingrained very, very early on to work hard. And so I was the first person in my family to go to college and first person in my family to go to grad school. Mm-hmm. And so since then, though, my brothers have come along, but it's I still am the only one who has a grad degree. And I focused primarily on in areas of social justice because of what I saw my parents doing.
Mm-hmm. Helping people just to make sure that they could make ends meet. Mm-hmm. So I saw my mother making connections with women of the congregation to find jobs. Mm-hmm. If they found jobs, finding daycare, finding housing. Like many of the congregants were recent immigrants who, church was their go-to place for support and help. Mm-hmm. And so I saw all of that. And so that really impacted me in terms of my career path. Sorry, I get very emotional around this, but that has really been my guiding star, if you will. Much of my work around in my graduate program, I focused on housing, community, and economic development, because if you can't live in a place, a box that is what we call a house, how can you possibly have a job or have start a business? So the two need to be together. And then community development, like, how does that work between those two spaces if you're not in community with one another and conversing and trying to solve problems? So my I focused on Chicano studies while at UCLA for my undergrad with a focus on immigration. And it was really, I had no idea what I wanted to be. I thought I was going to be a doctor. That was sort of my thought at the time. And I did 2 years of pre-med. And then I took OCHEM, organic chemistry, and that weeded me out. Like, that was what defined me at that time. So I had to pivot, and I pivoted to Chicano studies because I didn't feel like I knew enough about my background. And
you're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio.